he was worried that it would be corrupted, so he scrambled and came up with The Simpsons instead. And that's what he pitched him.
That's the biggest you never know.
Yeah. Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
You're just absolutely right. And I'm absolutely wrong. It must be nice to always believe you know better. To always think you're the smartest person in the room.
No, it's awful.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 177 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, and Aaron thinks it's conspiratorial. I'd like to welcome Aaron Dicer.
Oh, heidily ho, there's only 10 of them arenos.
Ah, yes, yes, indeed.
You usually plan better than that.
That's right. And also, welcome to the show, Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
Today's big recommend is broadcast news. Broads don't belong in broadcasting. Mm-hmm. A famous line in UHF, if everybody remembers that, yes. I also would like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. And let's get on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I will start us off. Small recommend that I have today is for Mr. Holland's Opus, a movie I hadn't seen in quite some time. I popped it in the other day because I have this like imported disc that I wasn't sure was going to work, and it ran absolutely fine. But this stars Richard Dreyfuss as a music teacher at a high school, and it's a multi-generational look at his life as it goes through, I believe, from the 60s to the 90s, 30-year career of teaching people and what the importance of teachers and the importance of music in people's lives. It also stars Glenna Headley as his wife, and she is awesome in this movie. There's a point where he, they have a child who is deaf, and there's a lot of struggles with that, trying to figure out. He obviously at the beginning doesn't really know what to do with a deaf child, especially when he is, he's a music teacher and he likes to teach music and everything. And I think he feels disappointed, and he doesn't know exactly what to do with him. So there's this father-son dynamic that grows throughout the film that's very, very beautiful to watch as it goes through and everything. But mostly it's about him and particular students and particular eras, and basically always the fight of having to deal with public funding and what they decide to cut when it comes to what they teach in high school and things of that nature. But the movie is your typical melodrama type of thing. It's really well done. It has a beautiful ending that might make you tear up. Hadn't seen it in a while. Thought I'd share this one. This is a good one.
Yeah, I think I only saw it the one time in theaters, but I remember loving it, and it did make me tear up, if I recall. So yeah, I need to revisit this.
Yeah, yep. It puts its finger on this truth about impact and how we undersell our impact on the lives around us because, you know, we weren't famous or we didn't invent something that changed the world or whatever, and how we undersell the little pieces that of ourself that we give to all those we come in contact with and the positive impact that we can have just by living our day-to-day life. And it really puts its finger on that in, I think, a really profound way with the way it structures the film. I also haven't seen it in a while, but it's a very moving film for sure.
Mm-hmm. What do you got, Aaron?
I want to talk about Alien Earth, the new TV show. Noah Hawley is in charge of this, and he's had success with other franchises and kind of bringing them to the small screen. I thought his X-Men TV show, that I'm forgetting the name of right here in this very moment, was really, really good. And I really am enjoying, so far, three episodes in, so we're just starting into this first season, but I'm really enjoying these characters. I'm really enjoying the structure. I'm enjoying the thematic work it's doing, specifically in the area of this hybrid type of creation that is both synth, but also the human consciousness is downloaded into the synth. And so it's kind of this third type of consciousness in the alien universe. He really knows how to play in this universe really well. The action is interesting and exciting. But I really like the, there's kind of a Peter Pan theme through this that I think really works well for, what these children in adult bodies are going through, because these hybrids, due to, expositional necessity, have to be children loaded into adult bodies. And so, you know, that Peter Pan theme works really well with that, and also gives an opportunity for some really interesting interactions. So, loving the cast, loving what's going on here. I think Sydney Chandler, who plays Wendy, kind of the centerpiece of this, is really good as well. And, of course, standout Timothy Oliphant playing a synth. Named Kirsch in this is really affecting. So yeah, good stuff going on here.
Her name's Wendy, and there's a Peter Pan theme.
That's what I'm saying. All of them, like, she's Wendy, and then like some of the others are like Nibs and So yeah, it's have definitely you... And they talk about it in the show itself. Like, one of the kids is like, why did I have to be named Nibs? Like, gotcha. So they even talk about it a little bit. But yeah.
Now I'm actually super excited about this. I love what Hawley did with Fargo as a TV series. And I'm very excited that this and the Predator brands are being revived with awesome stuff lately. Have you seen any Predator-related Easter eggs?
I'm kind of the worst at that. I don't spot Easter eggs a lot of times. They have to be pointed out to me.
Because the new one with the... Fanning, is it Elle Fanning?
Mm-hmm.
Predator Badlands, is that the one? Am I getting it right?
Yeah.
That trailer has like Weyland Corporation Easter eggs all over it.
Yeah.
And that's the company in Alien. And so I think that guy's clearly leaning that way. I just was kind of curious if they might like be coordinating things.
I mean, it's fully canon at this point that they're the same universe. It's not like it's almost not an Easter egg anymore. You know, I mean, there's literally been Alien versus Predator movies. So like,
yeah. But I think we're going there again.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think we're going to have more success this time.
Jeremy, what do you got?
I got an obscure little movie I stumbled on MGM. It is on MGM Plus. I was watching it on the movie channel on my television, and it's called Leroy, Texas. This is officially the second movie with Steve Zahn that has Texas in the title. He's also in Happy Texas. This is a 98 on Rotten Tomatoes and a 6.5 on IMDb. It's not just me who wants to say good things about this, but in a world full of Coen brother wannabes, this is one of the best I've seen in terms of striking the right tone of crime and comedy and surprise and unique small town characters and settings. Basically, this is John McGarro, who I most know from September 5 and in The Big Short. He's one of the two guys that works with Brad Pitt. And he's hired Steve Zahn, who's a private detective, to take pictures of his wife because he thinks his wife is having an affair. And it's proven he's got pictures of his wife having an affair. So he goes and buys a gun and drives to a motel parking lot where he's going to kill himself until a stranger gets in the car, mistaking him for a hitman that he has hired, and hands him a bag of cash and an address and says it has to be done tomorrow and leaves. I'm going to tell you a little bit more just to get you hooked. So the guy now with this cash is like, well, maybe I can save my marriage if I buy a beauty salon that my wife's always wanted to own and run. And maybe she'll stay with me. But this dude also gave me this money. I don't know how to hit, man, but he's probably going to expect me to do something. So he starts following the guy he finds at the address. But he's so bad. The guy basically catches him, gets in the car. There's a scuffle. And he shoots the fucking guy on accident. Mm-hmm. And he kicks the body out the door. And a picture of his wife having an affair falls out. I'll let you go from there. There's a lot of great actors in this. I have seen a lot of movies try to be like Fargo-esque. And this is one of the best I've seen in a long time. Mm. It's really confident. And it's really, all the twists make sense. And I kind of like the ending, which is a little bit unconventional, at least traditionally speaking. So on MGM Plus, Leroy, Texas, I highly recommend.
I had not heard of this at all, and now I'm going to have to watch it because you gave it such a good review and everything.
Yeah, I'll definitely get it on the list. In a world where even a singular Coen brother can't make a good Coen brothers movie, it'd be nice, to know that others still can.
Yes, yes. I kind of like that. I kind of dug that last one that came out. It wasn't great by any means. What was that called?
Driveaway Dolls or the new one?
Driveaway Dolls. Okay. Driveway Dolls. Yeah. I was kind of dug that movie a bit.
It's all right. It's just it's missing a lot, but it's okay. You can see what half of the Coen brothers he is.
That's what I was about to say. It's half of a Coen brothers movie. It's got stuff in it that you're like, "Oh, I love that. Why can't there be more of that?" Oh, yeah. Because there's one guy by
Joel's missing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Shout out to Martial Arts Film Freak who did the Leroy Texas. In the chat. All right. I'm going to go to our big recommend, which is broadcast news, and it is mine. So I will go ahead and start us off.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Broadcast News was written and directed by James L. Brooks. It was nominated for 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Screenplay, all 3 leads, the cinematography, and the editing, not winning any. Holly Hunter would lose to Cher for Moonstruck, which I do not agree with whatsoever. William Hurt would lose to Michael Douglas for Wall Street. That was kind of a hard category. Albert Brooks would lose to Sean Connery for The Untouchables. Another tough category. Let's see. The movie starts off with a young Tom Grunick, who will later be played by William Hurt, explaining early on what his problem is. He's a handsome dude, but maybe not the smartest guy in the room. Not for a lack of trying. We then move over to the young Aaron Altman, later to be played by Albert Brooks, who is apparently a super genius, graduating high school at the age of 15 and getting beat up by bullies shortly after the ceremony. We are then whisked over to a young Jane Craig, later played by Holly Hunter, who is an avid letter writer and is being scolded by her father for staying up too late writing pen pals. Her dad calls her obsessive, and then, to prove him wrong, she stops obsessively writing letters to lay into him about what the word obsessive means. Now, in the grown-up years, we see that Jane and Aaron are friends and colleagues. After a phone call with Aaron making fun of Arnold Schwarzenegger early on, we see Jane just break down and cry. Not too long after, we see them reviewing footage of Aaron tracking down a war hero turned mercenary for a quote who doesn't want to talk, who ends up just saying fuck to Aaron a whole lot. Jane has a huge speech where she derides what news has become. Everyone in the crowd seems disinterested except Tom. Jane sees that she's losing the crowd and tries to go off script and even skipping over all the important things in her speech to get to a tape that every network ran as a news item, a fun sequence of dominoes falling and turning into pictures. It gets the crowd back despite Jane's efforts, and it seems that everyone likes the idea of this being called news. Tom ends up meeting meeting with Jane after her failed speech to tell her how much he genuinely liked it. Jane very confidently asks Tom out for dinner, which he accepts. This seems to be going pretty well, except it's pretty clear that Tom is looking to a smart woman for advice and not really much of anything else. He apparently got his anchor job because an untrue story came out that, as a reporter, he was leaving the network and a bunch of protest phone calls and letters ended up getting him a promotion. The problem, in his mind, is that he's not actually good at being an anchor. It's pretty clear that Tom represents everything Jane is against, but also, as someone who is deeply attracted to him, she is falling into the trap that many others fall into when it comes to principles. Still, she lays into Tom for something a lot of people do. He seems to be admitting that he's terrible and making it seem like it's okay as long as he acknowledges it. Jane does not let him off the hook. He tells her that he hated the way she talked to him, and not just because she was right, and then the door closes between them. Despite having something extra to say, nothing else is said to each other for the night. Jane immediately calls her buddy Aaron to tell him about the failed attempt to get laid. Aaron never wanted to let an insult go by, tells Jane he must have been really good-looking because no one lets a bad-looking idiot into their room. Shortly after their conversation, Tom calls and says, "Oh, by the way, I was hired by your network and we'll be seeing each other a lot soon." Jane and Aaron rage about it the next morning. We are taken to a bustling news station in Washington, D.C. Jane is behind the scenes trying to get things ready for the day's broadcast, specifically Aaron's story on the mercenary that needs to be shown on their major affiliate in New York. Not only is there a time crunch, but Jane also wants to shoot and edit footage for a story just a mere 14 minutes before they go on air, which, even if they get it done, will have to be ran manually to the other side of the station by a hyperventilating Joan Cusack. Oh, wait, is that a surprise Jack Nicholson on the air in New York? He's playing network anchor Bill Rorisch. Tom wants to soak up more knowledge from Jane, who isn't having it. Tom makes a snide remark that this must have something to do with the fact that he left her hotel room instead of staying there. She holds back just enough to simply say that it's not personal. We move on to Nicaragua, where Jane and Aaron are covering the Sandinistas. The complexity of Jane is shown here when she smiles at the prospect of shooting happening later tonight, but also scolds a cameraman for staging news when he wants to get footage of a soldier putting on shoes. During the fighting later in the night, Aaron remarks to Jane, "I can't believe I just risked my life for a network that tests my face with focus groups. I don't feel good." During the middle of the show that this is broadcast, Bill calls Jane to tell her how much he enjoyed the story and how he's just going to have to bring her up to New York someday. But when Jane tries to give Aaron some credit, Bill's not interested. Aaron believes it has something to do with the fact that he said something about Bill's hairline a year and a half ago. Tom approaches Jane concerning a story about an expensive army vehicle that doesn't work. It's also an early peek into Tom's journalistic integrity because a story that seemingly involves two cameras is actually only being done with one camera, meaning impossible footage of Tom is making it into the edit, which isn't immediately recognized by the people in the room. And even though Tom's insertion into the story feels compelling, Aaron is the first to note that the footage seems to be making him the story. We go to a company party where Jennifer, played by Lois Childs, asks Jane if she can see Tom socially outside of work, since she seems close to Tom and doesn't want to get in the way. Jane says she doesn't mind before realizing, oh shit, she does. She outright admits she doesn't respect him, but she is attracted to him. But she also doesn't feel like she's telling Jennifer not to pursue him, leaving that whole situation confusing until Jane practically begs Jennifer to throw herself at Tom. Actual news is breaking at the party. A Libyan plane attacked a U.S. airbase in Sicily, and Ernie, played by Robert Prosky, tells Tom to tap into a source he has that can help with the story. Ernie hands out assignments to everyone. This is a story the Washington affiliate is going to have to produce and air because New York anchor Bill is unavailable. They want Tom as anchor, even though this is Aaron's bread and butter. Jane tries to talk to the president of the network, Paul Moore, played by real-life news correspondent Peter Hackus, to convince him that it should be Aaron's job and not Tom's. Paul waves off Jane's pleas as a matter of opinion, and she tells him he disagrees, which leads to one of my all-time favorite exchanges ever in a movie. You're just absolutely right, and I'm absolutely wrong. It must be nice to always believe you know better, to always think you're the smartest person in the room, to which Jane responds, no, it's awful. What follows is the centerpiece of the movie, with Tom anchoring a huge story with Jane as executive producer. Jane is in full command. Aaron, who was just going to stay home and be depressed about not being the anchor, decides he can help the broadcast by telling Jane everything he's learned about Libya over the years. Anyway, Tom, the guy who looks good on camera, is basically being fed lines from a Cyrano de Bergerac, Jane, and the broadcast sings because of it. There is some trouble when Jane gets distracted with some sort of parking issue and isn't feeding Tom things to say, which leads to another great moment when Tom improvises after reporting that the Libyan pilot was acting on his own. He says, in other words, I think we're all okay, to which Ernie says to himself, who the hell cares what you think? Anyway, after the broadcast, Tom finds Jane and explains what a great team they are. He invites her to a celebration at a bar, which she rejects initially because she's going to see Aaron, but then asks how long he'll be there. When she goes to visit Aaron, Aaron's been drinking a bit, and he tells Jane that he's in love with her, which is apparently a familiar refrain. I kind of wish, by the way, to break into this, they didn't have this scene because it breaks up that great thing later on. Mm. But anyway, they do have that scene in here. Aaron says he wishes she was two people so that he could call up the one who's his friend so that he can tell her about the woman he likes so much. He even gives her a big kiss and then jokes, well, I felt something. Anyway, by the time Jane makes it to the bar, it's a little too late. Tom and Jennifer appear to be going home together. Tom asks Jane out to a correspondence dinner, which appears to be an actual date for once. After that, the next story Tom does is a date rape story, and this is the one that puts everything on the line. It's a well-done report that everyone likes, where a woman, played by Marita Garrity, who played Nancy Taylor in Groundhog Day, tells her terrible story, complete with a cutaway to Tom, who is shown with a tear-streaked face. Tom asks Jane what she thought of it, and she says she probably wouldn't make the choice to cut to him crying, but maybe she's the one who's wrong because the story was emotional and it felt right. Ernie tells Aaron about cutbacks at the studio, which include firings. Aaron believes he definitely will be fired and asks Ernie if he can get one shot at being an anchor so he can try to prove himself. Because everyone wants off for the correspondence dinner on the weekend, Aaron is going to get his chance. Ernie wants him to get some pointers about some performance things, which definitely means with Tom. And then Aaron says, I think I better be alone for a while. To which Ernie responds, I understand. I'll go with you. Shortly after we see Tom giving Aaron tips about being an anchor, notably nothing having to do with the news at all. Aaron goes over to Jane's while she's preparing to go to the correspondence dinner, asking about outfits to wear on TV. It's here he finds out that Jane and Tom are going to the dinner together, and he gets a little jealous, asking her why it's not uncomfortable for her when he shows up while she's preparing for a date. She claims it's not a date, but while she says this, out of Aaron's sight, she puts a box of condoms in her purse, which will later come into play when they're about to go through a metal detector and she would be forced to empty the purse's contents in front of Tom. Aaron anchors the news and starts sweating pretty hard almost immediately, to the point that the drops of sweat are noticeably streaming down his face on camera. His shirt starts soaking through. In the attempt to save Aaron, the stagehands have ideas to give him a new shirt and or blow dry the sweat, but they run out of time and even run into the background fixture behind Aaron where it starts swaying. A visible hand shows up to fix it in the background. After Jane and Tom leave the correspondence dinner early because of her box of condoms, they go to the Lincoln Memorial where they kiss and Tom openly gropes her. It looks like they're going to have sex, but Jane remembers she was going to see Aaron after his broadcast, which breaks the spell momentarily. Jane tells Tom she'll meet him afterwards. Aaron tells Jane about the terrible broadcast, but he's not sad about it. He's glad, but only because Jane showed up and she definitely doesn't have plans to have sex with Tom later. But then she lets it out of the bag that she might be in love with Tom, to which Aaron responds very maturely by telling her to leave his house. But cooler heads prevail long enough for them to have a talk. Aaron reminds Jane that Tom represents everything she hates in news, and he says, don't get me wrong when I tell you that Tom, while being a very nice guy, is the devil. Aaron then fully commits and tells Jane that he loves her. Even though Jane isn't wooed by Aaron, the discussion is important enough to call Tom and tell him that she's going to run later than normal. He tells her that he's not some task that she has to cross off on her schedule, and things officially go cold. Aaron even cold shoulders her a bit by telling her, "Thanks for stopping by." The next day at work, Jane gives Tom a tongue lashing for his behavior, asking if he's only showing interest in her because she can help him with his career, but is embarrassed when she finds out his dad is in the office. Bill Rorisch visits the office, which seems awesome, but it's a prelude for the bad news that many are about to get fired. Bill laments the business side of news, where they can't stay afloat because the network can't properly program other shows to keep them solvent. Paul says, "Well, we could keep some of them if you knocked a million or so off for your salary." Anyway, the firings commence shortly after. Tom gets promoted to be in London, which is what they did with Bill before making him the network anchor. They're making Jane the bureau chief, which puts Ernie out of a job. They tell Aaron they're fine with what he does at his salary, so he quits and eventually takes a job at the number two station in Portland. Aaron confirms with Tom, somewhat out of the blue, if he had only one camera crew on the date rape story. Tom asks Jane if they can try to get away for a while to see how they are away from the office. She wants to do it. Next scene, Jane calls up Aaron because he didn't tell her about quitting, so they go to meet at the place near the thing where they went that time. Aaron is in full-on move-on mode, resigned to the fact that they'll never be a couple, resigned to the fact that no one appreciates what he offers in the news world. But before he leaves, he turns this movie into a CinemaSins by asking Jane how Tom could have gotten that shot of him crying in the date rape story when he only brought one camera to the interview. Jane then reviews the footage and finds out that Tom worked up the tears after the fact to make it look like he was crying in the moment. And while in the actual moment he was about to cry and the producer thought it was a shame they couldn't get that on camera, the dishonesty is enough for Jane to meet Tom at the airport and tell him she's not going on the romantic trip with him and tells him exactly why. The movie goes on to a 7 years later prologue, or epilogue, I guess. Wait a minute. Is it epilogue? It's epilogue, right?
Epilogue.
Yeah, it's epilogue. I said prologue. I wrote prologue. What the hell? Where Tom is taking Bill's place after retirement. He is making a speech where he said he took the job as long as he wasn't also the managing editor, which is a statement about the state of the news the movie is making through Tom's self-deprecation. Additionally, he's getting married to someone named Lila. Aaron is at the speech and introduces Tom to his son Clifford, who then asks who Tom is, says, "The big joke?" Aaron and Tom then go over to meet Jane, where she reveals that she's going to be that managing editor Tom was talking about earlier. She also mentions she's been seeing someone from the Surgeon General's office. The movie ends with Aaron and Jane talking as old friends do under the gazebo. And that's broadcast news. Guys, what did you think?
Aaron, you or me?
I'll go first. This is one of the greatest movies ever made. It is just front to back a pleasure to watch. There are many reasons for that, from the performances to the incredible writing to the way the performances highlight the incredible writing. There are some killer line deliveries in this movie. And you mentioned a lot of them, Chris, in your in your synopsis. The way Holly Hunter says, "No, it's awful," is so perfect. And
which hate to break in on this already, but I did watch the commentary on this earlier this morning, and apparently that was the 17th take.
Wow.
that he was trying to get that perfect reaction, right. and he did it about 20 times apparently, and that was the one.
Well, you got it because that was the one for sure.
Yeah.
The delivery is key in what may be in my top five movie quotes of all time, where Albert Brooks says, "There's only 10. and even the follow-up to that is perfect, where he's like, "You're feeling really good right now, aren't you?" He's like, "I'm feeling pretty good," or whatever he says. You know, it's
I'm starting to.
Yeah. It's just perfect. So, like, you put all that together, and you just have this really great watch. But then on top of that, or maybe underneath that, maybe layered underneath that, there's this incredible exploration of a very prescient thing about where news was heading, even at the time and even more today, where it's not really news, unless you think of news as something separate from journalism, which I understand can be a distinction, but it's entertainment. And entertainment cares about how good looking the host is and how your shoulders look, or, you know, that you're not sweating. But news doesn't. News should be information that is immune to those kinds of things. And I just think that the movie has some spot on things to say about that. The other thing that really, really works in this movie for me is how much empathy this movie has for all three of its main characters. It is a very different movie where the Tom character is a complete jerk that we're not supposed to like. Because that's where the script goes. She leaves him. Like, she has an awakening to her idea of journalistic ethics don't match up with his, and she leaves him at the airport. They go their separate ways. And there's a world where this is a realization about the Tom character in a much, not darker necessarily, but more pointed way. You know, he's much more of a jerk. But it gives Tom a lot of empathy in this movie, you know, a lot of ability to be just different and not necessarily evil, even with the speech about being the devil, you know, with the fruits of the devil. He's not really portrayed that way. We get three different instances of Holly Hunter just breaking out in tears. And I think that's so powerful, because all of this has to go somewhere, and it's just private moments. She'll just break out in tears. And even the Albert Brooks character is, you know, he's a sad sack in a lot of ways, but it really gives him the empathy of being, you know, the smartest one in the room at times, and the ability for him to, you know, even as he is flop sweating, find a way to be not just have a sense of humor about it, but actually persevere through it and learn something about himself through that. And I think he learns something about himself with that relationship too, that unrequited love. He learns, you know, he says something about, and we'll just be friends and we'll get hot for each other at dinner every 6 years and we will never, ever act on it or whatever, you know, like he has a way to push through. I just really like how this movie spends time enough with its characters to understand them as complete human beings, not just these stereotypes or caricatures. There are a lot of other moments, a lot of alliterations from Anxious Anchors placed in powerful positions, is one of my favorite moments. You mentioned the, okay, I'll meet you at the place near the thing where we went that one time, and Holly Hunter just being like, okay, it's like, there's something so beautifully unspoken there, that I think is great. And the other moment I wanted to bring up was the Jack Nicholson moment. Where, and you mentioned this as well, Chris, where the guy says you can make it less brutal by knocking off a million or so of your salary, and then just the apoplectic apologies that can, look at me doing the alliteration as well, that just come out of this guy afterwards. Like, he realizes, oh, actually, this is the guy with more power than me. It doesn't matter what our titles are. It doesn't matter, you know, like, this guy can get me fired. So he is just apologizing. Bad joke. I'm sorry. And just the way the camera follows Jack Nicholson, and we still hear him apologizing in the background. It's just genius.
And it's also great on his part that he doesn't say anything at all to this. It's like, I've got so much power in this situation, I don't need to say anything here. You know, you already feel bad enough. I don't need to put you in your place. You've already done it. So I love it.
Yeah. So anyways, it's just a movie full of great moments, great meaning. Boy, it's a good one. This is a good one.
You guys have already said most of the quotes I was going to say, but there's a confidence to this movie, and the beats of the story are perfectly paced. There's even that one moment, I forget what comes before it, but it jump cuts to her on the pier in Central America crying, but it's a smash cut to her just crying. the pacing, the editing, I think it really guides you through the emotional beats of the story. I think Albert Brooks is, obviously all three of them are great. All three of them are award worthy. Albert Brooks, probably Holly Hunter, but Albert Brooks is maybe the only one I would say nobody else could really do this. Because you have to be every man enough, but also really witty and funny. And I just, the older I get, the more appreciation I gain for Albert Brooks as an actor, as a comedian. His timing is impeccable. I think he's ultimately, for me, the heartbeat for the movie, the character I identify with most, right? I was never the William Hurt, dumb, good-looking guy. I was never smart, good-looking guy either. But I did feel like smarter than the good-looking, dumb guys in my school. And in competing for attention from girls, I always felt like I was the underdog, if you will. I will say it is Albert Brooks's likability that he infuses this character with that allows him to do one of the most heinous things I've ever seen. And that is when he tells Holly Hunter about the second camera, about the second camera for the date rape story. There, that is an ethical lapse in my mind, for a friend. She's clearly going to figure this out eventually, not necessarily the two cameras, but that she's not compatible with Tom because Tom's ethics are not compatible with her ethics, no matter how good he gets at the job. And it just felt so freaking mean this time through, that it kind of bugged me. Not the movie's bad. It bugged me. The character had made this decision to do this to his friend. But again, he's only able to do that because we like him so much and we're rooting for him so much. And like you said, Aaron, I like the fact that they didn't make Tom a dickhead or a jerk. Like a lazy movie would have done that. But there are reasons to root for all three of them, at least at points. I did want to mention one quote in that early scene where they don't sleep together, Holly Hunter and William Hurt. Where she says, it's hard for me to advise you since you personify something that I think is truly dangerous. And she says meaner stuff after that, but I thought that was a really good line and really delivered. You gotta have certain actors to deliver these kind of intelligent burns that don't use like swear words and whatnot, but use large vocabulary words. okay, something I picked up this view through that I had never heard before. When they're all in the newsroom watching Tom's story about the Allen armored vehicle that the military spent $5 billion on and it doesn't really work, he confronts the general outside a building, and the camera angle changes to the general from William Hurt. And in the background, and there's other dialogue, but in the background I hear somebody say, so Tom rates two cameras, eh? And I have never heard that line in my entire life, and it is perfect foreshadowing for what Tom goes on to do with the date rape story and the ultimate reveal that kills his relationship. I love that Aaron doesn't call in the tips because he likes Jane. He does it because he's a fan of news and the news being as good as possible. I thought that was a moment of high integrity for his character. Yeah, you mentioned that quote already. I do love, I don't think you mentioned this one, when Tom says, what do? When your real life exceeds your dreams. And Aaron goes, keep it to yourself. I think Aaron anchoring and everything going off the rails is hands down one of the top 10 funniest scenes in all of film history. I think it is perfect in the way that it builds that comedy.
When that hand comes in, it's just, oh my God. The theater must have been dying.
Your hand's in the shot. Your hand!
He says hand about 15 times.
I love that none of them end up together. Again, a worse movie would find a way to put two of them together at the very end. Probably Aaron and Jane, even though I don't think any of them really belong together. I love Tom still being so dumb at the end that he doesn't realize London is a big promotion. He stays true to character all the way through. And I read on IMDb, one other thing I definitely wanted to share is that Albert Brooks is the one that came up with the sweating profusely thing. The script apparently just said something bad happens to Aaron on the air. And after having read that script, he's up late at night watching CNN, Albert Brooks is, and sees an anchor he's never seen before who's sweating profusely, and he called James L. Brooks at 3 a.m. to tell him this is what that scene needs to be about. I thought that was a fantastic story. Yeah, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. I don't think there's a single thing wrong with it. Like you said, Aaron, it's just a delight to watch from start to finish.
It really is.
Yeah, I come out of this. I, of course, love Albert Brooks in this. It feels like a more well-rounded version of the version he's playing of himself in Taxi Driver, where he's obviously pining for Sybil Shepherd all the way through that movie. But, like, you know, here comes De Niro and, you know, robbing him of his dreams and everything. But Holly Hunter on this one, I've always known that she's great in this movie, but I don't know. This particular viewing made me just fall in love with her all over again. The James L. Brooks said that he had not seen anything with her in it. I guess she had not done that much before this. And she had a 3-year hiatus. It like did some stuff in the early 80s, and then there was like a 3-year hiatus before Raising Arizona came out the same year. And he had apparently Raising Arizona had come out or had not come out yet, and he had not seen it. So he basically felt like he had made a discovery with Holly Hunter on this and everything. But just watching how she reacts to everything when Aaron tells her that he loves her and everything, and there's like this that the editing is in such a way where it doesn't cut immediately to her reaction. It lets her hear it first and then the reaction, like, you know, that reaction she gives, that that look. She doesn't react immediately in the editing. She's got that look like, I'm listening to what you're saying, I'm processing it, and then, oh my god, what did you just say to me? And just the way that she reacts all the way through this, I think feel like it's note perfect on almost every single moment throughout. And when I went back and reviewed all the actresses who were in the Oscar race that year, I mean, I know Moonstruck had sort of like a moment in time there where everybody was just in love with that movie, and I guess they just wanted to give Cher something, man, because that Cher's performance is good and it's very showy, but it isn't Holly Hunter in this movie. I can tell you that right now. If I were to retro the Oscars, I definitely would give it to her. Although there's like 3 other performances in this category I haven't seen. Like Meryl Streep, of course, was nominated for Ironweed, and I haven't seen that. And there's a couple others that I haven't seen, but this William Hurt character is fascinating to me on many, many levels. It's someone who doesn't want to just be, he doesn't just want to be known for his looks, and he wants to be respected as an anchor and everything, but he's realizing he doesn't have to do all the things that he's hoping to do. And so, like, I don't think he ever gets in the mode of feeling like he needs to work super hard at it. I mean, there's some things he's pretty clearly good at in this. To be able to process the information that Holly Hunter is giving him during the middle of that broadcast, where he's just in the middle of a sentence, and then she tells him some fact that's not going to come out of his mouth for another 10 seconds or so, is kind of an amazing thing. And he not only takes the information, but he puts it in his own words, and he makes it where it snaps a lot better. So he's clearly good at the performance part of all of this and everything. And everything that he's just dying to get good at, he doesn't realize that he's needed to spend a lot more time on it. He needs to be, like, you know, breathing the news, basically. And he's never had to do that. And he's never been asked to do that because of just being good looking and whatever. And he's just always going to feel like a fraud no matter what. But as he says when Holly Hunter is like, you know, tells him that, you know, the ethics that he broke by switching the camera and turn and crying and all that. And he's like that, you know, when she talks about him breaking the ethics, he's like, they keep moving that line just a little bit, don't they? Every time they just keep moving it. And so like, yeah, he's willing to go along with it as long as he's successful. And it's, he knows he's a fraud, but like, yeah, I'd like to know what people think really of his character in the end, because he kind of ingratiates himself to us through the way he does in the movie. I'm a fraud. I'm telling you I'm a fraud, but you know, because I admit it and I'm good looking, I think you're going to forgive me for that. And that's what keeps happening all the way through this. And, you know, to be able to get the number one anchor job at the end and not really know the news that you're saying out there, you don't know what you're talking about. God, that's such a huge statement this movie is making.
I love that scene in her bedroom where she realizes he's dumb. Where he's like, no, you keep thinking I'm somebody who lacks confidence. And I forget exactly how he phrases it, but he's like, I don't even understand the news. And he like cuts off and you her facial expression changes, like, whoa, wait a minute. You don't understand the news you're reading? He's got imposter syndrome, but because he's an actual imposter, at least as a newsman, as a news reader, he shouldn't, because he's very good at that.
So, Yeah, as long as he's got somebody in his ear, he's going to be fine. And, you know, and then at the end, I don't know what to think of Holly Hunter taking that job at the end. Like, you know, it makes sense because she's driven to be in this business and make the impact that she wants. But she's going to be, again, she's going to be falling into that trap of, well, this guy doesn't really know the news really at all, and I'm going to just keep feeding him the lines the entire time, and he's just going to take the credit for it the entire time. So yeah, that ending to me is all sorts of emotions at the end, because it's the expected Hollywood ending is to get one of them together and none of them end up together, and then they're taking jobs that they don't really. I mean, William Hurt's getting the job he wants, obviously, but Holly Hunter's not getting, I don't know. She's basically having to face the fact that she's going to have to be okay with these frauds that read the news. And then she's going to have to be the backbone of these people when it comes down to it. So, the movie says a lot without saying everything right in your face at the very end of it. And I very much appreciate that. James L. Brooks, man, what a career he had had up until this point. His life is going to change completely. Even though he was the driving force of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He was on Taxi. He did Terms of Endearment and won all the Oscars for that. And then he does this movie, and it's not as big of a hit, and it doesn't do much at the Oscars, but then he produces the Tracy Ullman Show, which leads to The Simpsons, which that's basically the capper on this guy's life.
I just read the other day, I think it was over the weekend, that when Tracy Ullman Show asked Matt Groening to adapt his Life is Something.
Life in Hell.
He was worried that it would be corrupted, so he scrambled and came up with The Simpsons instead. And that's what he pitched
it. That's the biggest you never know of all time. Yeah. It's got to be. It's got to be one of them.
He's back this year. He's got a new movie out for the first time in 15 years this year coming out.
James L. Brooks
wrote, directed, and produced
all of his Ella movies. McKay, I'll say, I fell in love with Broadcast News, I went and watched all of his. I think he's only directed 8 movies. All of them have something, some heartbeat you can connect to. Even that Nick Nolte one, which was the worst of the bunch.
Oh, I'll do anything.
Yeah, but As Good as It Gets is really good. He obviously likes working with Nicholson. But yeah, I went through and watched all of them and came away thinking he was a really good director.
Yeah. December 12th is when it comes out.
All right.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what he can come up with now that he's, I think, 85 years old.
Yeah, he's old.
But all right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
What do you guys think?
Aaron, I have four that I think are really solid, so I'm going to let you go.
Okay. I have one that is just too perfect for me not to use, so for in my opinion, and that is His Girl Friday. I think, like, tonally, if you want kind of the same viewing experience in the same genre, this is a perfect double feature. You've got Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell as the primary characters. Cary Grant and plays Walter, and she is Hildy, and they have divorced. But the movie is about him wooing her back as she is getting ready to be engaged to somebody else. But it takes place in newspaper journalism, not in television journalism. And there are some of the same themes in the background of this movie that is ostensibly a love story, but there's a lot else going on. Plus, if you want great dialogue and lines and moments like you have in broadcast news, this movie is full of them. Mile a minute, great, clever stuff going on here. It is a Howard Hawks movie, and there's this great fourth wall kind of meta joke in this movie that we think that meta is something new, but, you know, it's been going on a while. Ralph Bellamy plays the prospective husband, Bruce Baldwin. And at one point, somebody asks Cary Grant what her fiance looks like. And he said, like a Ralph Bellamy type, you know, and mentions the actor. And it's also a play on the fact that apparently Ralph Bellamy was typecast as this kind of guy in like every movie he was in. So
yeah, he was the same exact thing in The Awful Truth with the same with Cary Grant. Yeah. Yeah.
So just a really funny movie, deals in the same world of journalism and some of those ethics, and lots of fun.
We did this on this podcast, right?
Yeah, it was episode 65 according to what I was looking at.
Throws herself out the window suddenly, or is that a different
thing? Yes.
I think so. Okay.
That's how I remember this movie. I mean, I need to watch it more. I really liked it. I remember liking it.
Yeah, it's so fun.
That was my takeaway. What the hell was that girl jumping out of the window?
I'm not sure if it's this one or if it's The Awful Truth, but there's another meta thing where he says something like, "That reminds me of my old friend Archie Leach," which is, you know, of course his real name. Yeah. So the old meta thing has been a thing for quite some time. They used to do it a lot back in the day. They do it more back then in the day than they do now, I think.
Yep.
So anyway, Jeremy, what do you got?
That's a good call. I'm going to tell you three, but my main one I'm going to give you first because I think what I wanted to do with my double feature was find a modern film that talks about what news is, what it's becoming, and how it may be corrupted. So tonally, we're not going to match here. Topically, I think we will. And that's Nightcrawler.
That was my second choice. Yes.
Was it really?
Yes.
That's awesome. That makes me very happy. It's not going to have any of the comedy or the romance, but it is a very modern look at, I think, the same issue that this movie, Broadcast News, is looking at, and how Jake Gyllenhaal, like, if it bleeds, it leads, but how Jake Gyllenhaal ultimately begins manipulating the news footage that he is selling. And I just think they'd go hand in hand if we were going to have a sit-down, you know, discussion afterwards about the news. I really wanted to go with the corruption of something pure that had a love triangle. And so I flirted with Reality Bites for a good while. And I think it would have been fine. But I don't like that movie enough. And then if I was going to go with tone that still had the theme of the corruption of something pure, and I thought, Aaron, you might use Quiz Show, was another one that I thought of. But Nightcrawler, I think if I was programming this festival, that would be my double feature for broadcast news, and we span 40-some years, two looks at the same problem.
That would be an excellent double feature. I would love the whiplash that causes. Yeah.
Well, what made me think of it, very specific scene in broadcast news that made me think of it. They're all standing in the hallway, and the Albert Brooks character lays out a scenario. I forget the specific scenario.
Would you film the guy out of the electric chair?
Yeah, electric chair. Yeah. Let's say we got permission. Would you? And all of them are like, yeah, obviously. Yeah, of course. Obviously. Of course. And then he ends up going, aren't ethical conversations fun, or whatever he says at the end of that. That reminded me of Nightcrawler so much. If it leads, it bleeds kind of thing. And that's what kind of got me thinking in that zone. But yeah, it's a good call.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let's go on to what our next week's homework is. And I believe it is Jeremy's turn. So, Jeremy, what do you got for us?
Back in the day, in the early days of Wreckatopia, I big recommended a Donnie Yen movie called Ip Man. It's a kung fu movie. And it does have a little bit of humor, but it's played pretty straightforward. So here I am coming back to Donnie Yen, one of my favorite movies ever, and we're going to watch Iron Monkey from 1993. If you are not familiar with this film, the kung fu in this movie is awesome, but some of it is enhanced by magic. And sort of like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but more comedic. And the overall tone of the film is going to be more fun as opposed to serious and dramatic. This is basically a Robin Hood story in ancient China. Two of the characters, Donnie Yen and his son, they're both real people in real life. They're being fictionalized here, who were renowned martial artists in this era the film takes place in. And basically they are brought in or basically forced to try and hunt down the Iron Monkey, the Robin Hood, who is robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. I can't wait to watch this movie again. It's been a good 5 years. It's on Pluto TV for free. Yes, directed by, let me get the name right, Yen Wu Ping, the martial arts coordinator, fight coordinator on the Matrix movies.
That was the whole Wire Fu stuff was because of him. Yeah. And well, you'll at least see some popularized by him.
Yep. Yeah. You'll see some of that wire work, in Iron Monkey as well. So yeah, there you go. That's your homework.
So I can't remember if I've even seen this movie, honestly. I feel like I have. The tone isn't like Kung Fu Hustle, though. It's not like Looney Tunes kind of comedy.
It's not slapstick. It's just there's more quips in the fighting, stuff like that. You need to know that some of these guys, as they go through the bosses, some of them are going to be able to do things that appear to be inspired by magic, which is fairly common in Kung Fu lore and whatnot, but I just didn't want you going in thinking it was just going to be, two people on the ground kicking, because some of them can sort of fly.
Is that your impression of martial arts movies? Two people on the ground kicking. Got it.
People having a slap fight.
Yes. I've never seen this. All right. So I'm excited to check this out. At least I'm pretty sure I've never seen this. So
I think you will find it to be a very Jeremy movie. So
nice. Well, you can't spell Kung Fun without Kung Fu.
That's true. That's so true.
It's true.
That's so true.
A lot of things are true.
All right. That's going to do it for this week. Chat, once again, thanks for coming out and watching us talk about movies today. Appreciate you very much for coming out. Can't wait to talk about Iron Monkey next week, but we'll see you next week. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Bye. Be a part part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Well, the pandemic basically got me and my wife, we cut each other's hair now.
Mm-hmm.
So she's got a very simple, she doesn't really style her hair much. She puts it up in a bun and goes about her day. And so whenever it gets too long, I trim it for her, and then she'll buzz my hair and trim my neck and all that. She didn't even have to go to whatever the school they go to, but she's turned into quite the little hair cutter.
Yeah.
I mean, if all I need to do is this, just buzz it.
Right.
But, yeah, I haven't been to a proper haircut in probably 5 years.
It saves money, man.
Well, it saves money, and it helps that I don't really go anywhere. And when I do, I don't really care how nice I look.
Yeah.
So, like, if I'm going to go, even if I were to go to, like, a Ruth Chris steak dinner, I would still wear a ball cap and a t-shirt, like. It's just how I'm most comfortable. So,
right. Yeah. It's, I think if you ever do decide to go back, you will be shocked at how much it costs to get just a basic haircut anymore. It's,
you last know, time I felt like it was like $15, $14, maybe $12. I don't know. I used to go to Great Clips.
You could probably find a Great Clips haircut for $25, I'm guessing.
Oh, now I have to look.
Maybe $20. I don't know.
Those tariffs on those hair clippers must be huge.
So I pay $50 for mine.
Okay.
But it's only every 10 weeks. So okay. I justify that as, you know, $25 a month kind of thing.
But you probably also are getting like a shampoo. And
oh, yeah.
Like...
It's full service. I get a massage, all sorts of wonderful things. Oh, yeah.
Man, I did get a gift card. This was years ago to Sport Clips, which is basically they put sports on TVs on the wall and charge you more. That was the first time. God, I'm so like rural. That was the first time I'd ever gotten a shampoo before I got a haircut.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I felt like I was the king. Like I felt every bit of that pampering.
You felt like you were the godfather at an Italian barbershop, you know, it's getting the shave.
It was a great feeling. I mean, I understand why people do it. Totally get it. It's very relaxing, even without a massage in addition. Uh-huh. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she always uses a straight razor on my like neck hair or, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's always interesting, too.
That's trust
mm-hmm.
right there. That's trust. Like,
yep.
Didn't you just mention Al Capone?
I mentioned The Godfather, but yeah, sure.
Well, there's in Untouchables, he's getting shaved with a straight razor, and the guy nicks him.
Yeah,
everyone thinks he's going to kill him. hey, you know what? I don't even understand a little bit. Burning Man. Like Burning Man is going on right now.
Well, what happens is when you put flame to something, it burns. I don't understand burning, man.
Man. I don't get it. I don't get why it started. I don't get how it's popular. It sounds like the most miserable few days I could possibly imagine. It's either arid and dusty and hot and everyone is smelly and sweaty, or it rains and everything's flooded and muddy and you can't leave for an extra couple of days.
Yeah.
There's no central point other than the large titular Burning Man, which I think happens at the end. And so I think there's some music. I think there's arts and crafts, and I think there's tents and drugs, and it just makes no sense to me. Like a music festival makes sense to me. Like Bonnaroo. I would never go. It sounds like hell, but at least, hey, there's bands you like and you make new friends and you dance around with neon stuff and take drugs. I understand why you would go to that. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why you would go to Burning Man. You got to go 7 hours out of your way into the desert. And then what are we doing? What are we doing while we're there?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a little bit of like anarchy to it. There's a little bit of, you know, just come be the exact representation of your hippy dippy self. And, you know, like,
there's... I see. Is it one of those like super accepting, like,
yeah, yeah.
Okay. I didn't know
this. I think that, I mean, that's always been the impression I get, is that the idea is just like, you know, let your freak flag fly. You know,
okay.
This is a place where you can just do that.
Well, they apparently had a huge dust storm that like got inside everybody's RVs, even with closed windows.
You're right in saying maybe they could have been a little better in picking the location.
Yeah. Here's Google's AI overview, which I'm sure we can trust.
Mm-hmm.
The point of Burning Man is multifaceted, Aaron.
Of course.
It's an annual event and a global cultural movement focused on community, art, self-expression, and self-reliance.
Yeah, there you go. It's a very feels like a very tribal thing, just like a very essence of, you know, existence. And
at its core, it is about experiencing radical self-expression. Radical.
That's what I'm saying. That's the impression I get, is just like, it's, you know, come let your freak flag fly, you know?
It looks like Mad Max. Like, I'm glad they all have freak flags that they get to fly, and I'm proud of them. I don't want to be there. I got other ways to fly my flags. Thank you very much.
I mean, it'd be some incredible people watching.
Well, but in 110 degree
weather?
That's
what I'm saying. You're right. Like, the environment, I'm not sure.
I'm sure we're using porta potties this whole time. That's got to be fun.
If you want, just pop a squat wherever.
Yeah. What if my radical self expression is not using the porta potty?
No one's gonna arrest you for it.
It's Burning Man, man.
Trying to think like the closest thing I've ever done to Burning Man. It would have to be like summer camps, right?
I was
like,
gonna say church camp.
Yeah.
For me.
Some weird stuff goes on at church camps, summer camps.
There's plenty of freak flags flying at the church camp, at least when I went.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Lots of
self-expression.
Yeah.
I remember a guy who always wore a white t-shirt with a giant 3D nose sticking out of it. Like, it stuck out like 12
That's
inches.
Amazing.
All right. Well, you didn't miss anything except me bitching about Burning Man, which is something I've never even been to, so I don't really like to complain about it.
It feels like every time I turn on my computer before podcast, like if I'm cutting it a little close, that's when the computer is like, oh, I need to do a lot of things.
Yep.
Sorry. And if I'm here well within the time range, it's like, everything's good.
And where are Aaron and Jeremy? Because sometimes that's when my computer decides to do stuff,
yeah.
Right before the episode. Yeah.
So anyway, it did not have anything saying there's updates that needed to be installed or anything. And whatever reason, Adobe Cloud was just the whole desktop was just blank. It wouldn't let me click on anything. So I was like, all right, if it's going to keep doing that, I guess I'll just restart the computer. And then when I restarted it, it was like, blah, 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 don't turn off the computer, blah, 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 don't turn it off. And I was like, I did turn it off because I was tired of it doing its thing. And then when I turned it back on, it was just like, blah, 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 don't turn off the computer, blah, blah, blah. I was like, how did you know?
We all have computers.
We all have computers.